This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. Straight ahead on the program, Boeing's in the spotlight as the airline industry gathers in Seoul. I'm Bob Moon in New York.
I'm Amy Morris in Washington. A head-snapping moment for Mexico and for Capitol Hill as the president announces surprise tariffs.
And I'm Matt Miller in London, where we're looking ahead to U.S. President Donald Trump's visit to the U.K.
I'm Jessica Summers in New York, where we're looking at gasoline production, prices, and imports at the start of the summer driving season here in the U.S.
And in Asia, India's RBI tees it up in the coming week to cut or not to cut. I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong with that story coming up.
Plus, a look inside Apple's upcoming Worldwide Developer Conference.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Bob Moon. We begin today's program with the U.S. economy. May's jobs report is due out this week, and Fed officials will be watching closely amid low inflation and political pressure to cut rates. Joining me now to discuss this is Michael McKee, Bloomberg International Economics and Policy Correspondent. Jobs haven't been looking too bad, Michael.
No, jobs have been one part of a really healthy economy so far. 263,000 jobs created last month. Now, the forecast is for a significant decline to 190,000. 190,000 would have been considered a great report a few months ago.
Yeah.
So at this point, it still looks pretty good. And the unemployment rate expected to stay at 3.6%.
What about wage growth, though?
Well, wage growth was disappointing last month if you consider a tenth of a percent lower than forecast to be disappointing. And we're expecting to make that up in the month of May when we get the report. Year-over-year number is not going to change much, 3.2%. That's still considered within the range of what the Fed would like to see and expects to see when you have this low unemployment. It's just that it's not accelerating any faster. And that's kind of the confusion at the Fed is, why not?
We've been seeing more and more concern about the tariff wars, particularly with China. Is that going to affect things?
It will show up in the jobs report. We've already started to see it. We've started to see steel jobs go away. The steel industry has expanded in the United States, but largely through the use of automation. So while there was a ramp up in jobs in the beginning, it hasn't continued. And so we'll watch to see if that's the case. We've seen jobs in appliance manufacturing drop, the washing machine tariffs that we saw last year. This is non-farm payrolls, so we won't get a real read on what's happened down on the farm because of the agriculture tariffs, but one can assume from some of the numbers we've seen of farm bankruptcies that there may be fewer farmers out there as well.
Yeah, we've heard lots of reports of distress in the agriculture business. What about the Fed? What are they going to be watching for in all of these numbers?
Well, in the jobs numbers, they keep an eye on the average hourly earnings because their main goal at this point is to keep track of inflation. And the theory is that a low unemployment rate will raise wages, and that will eventually feed through to higher prices as companies make up for the lost margin when they have to pay workers more. But so far, they've been able to absorb the pay increases, and there hasn't been an uptick in inflation. And the question is, will there ever be, or has inflation dynamics changed, or is it just delayed? And at some point, will hit. That's what they're watching for.
So what is it going to take to get, I've been asking this question for years, to get inflation burning?
You know, before we get the jobs report, there's a big Fed conference in Chicago this coming week. We'll be asking that question. You know, what about the Fed's policies needs to change because the 2% inflation target hasn't been hit? And over the last 20 years, so a lot of people don't realize this, the PCE inflation index that the Fed follows has averaged 1.8%. And since they adopted the target in 2012, it's averaged 1.4%. So is that still a realistic goal, or can we live with lower inflation? That's going to be the question out there because nobody really knows how to generate it right now.
Is that I think I can number, or are we ever going to get to 2%?
Well, it's one of those numbers that works in theory. And the theory is we'll see higher inflation and the Fed will react once it gets above 2% for a little while. But the idea is that you create inflation expectations in the market and that helps drive up inflation. And it hasn't happened and nobody quite knows why.
I asked you about tariffs earlier. How concerned is the Fed about that?
Well, they're keeping an eye on it. The Fed's last meeting was in March, and Donald Trump ratcheted up the trade war at the beginning of May. And so they haven't had a real chance to consider what will happen. There's always been a feeling out there in the market, certainly, that, this is just posturing. We will get an agreement and all will be right with the world. And we've seen in the last week that maybe the markets are beginning to price in the possibility that all will not be right with the world. The trouble for the Fed is it's hard to measure what the impact is because you can guess at how many jobs might be lost or how much GDP might be lost. But what's the impact of falling markets on spending and on confidence if the markets get scared that the China trade war is going to be damaging? So it's something they're keeping a close eye on, but they don't really know yet.
The irony here is because of the tariffs, the president might get what he wants, and that is a rate cut.
Well, it would take some time for that to happen. The Fed is content to sit on the sidelines. They're not going to be bullied by the markets. They sort of went on hold after the December ructions in the markets. But their view is the data would have told us to do that anyway. And so at this point, they're going to stay on hold as long as they can. Unless we see a significant dive in inflation that's sustained over a couple of months, they're going to stay on hold and not cut rates because there is still the possibility the trade war ends, and there is the possibility that we see inflation at least maintained, if not rise. So they don't see an urgency to cut.
Our thanks to international economics and policy correspondent Michael McKee. And coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, pressure continues to mount on Boeing, plus a key event for Apple. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Let's turn to aviation now, where the grounded 737 MAX jet continues to plague Boeing as the aerospace giant gets set to face the world's airlines at the International Air Transport Association in Seoul. For more, let's turn to George Ferguson, senior aerospace defense and airlines analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, on the line with us now. George, thank you for joining us. So Boeing is a very big part of the U.S. economy, and this has got to be hurting.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Boeing is, but it's not really hurting yet. And so what Boeing has done is, in the interim, while they're waiting for the MAX 6 to be approved and the airplane to reenter fleets, they continue to pull supplies from their suppliers to build 52 airplanes a month, the level they were building up before the grounding. And they're building, they're actually assembling 42 of them a month and not laying anyone off. So right now, we really haven't felt any effects from the MAX grounding on the U.S. economy. If it becomes much more protracted than Boeing thinks, I think it will have an effect, and they'll have to knock down production rates, and they'll have to knock down what they're getting from suppliers. But we actually expect that the airplane to be back in the air by fourth quarter of this year, and that won't happen.
Is this a big gamble for Boeing? They're basically banking on the fact that they can restore this airplane's image.
For sure, it's a gamble. We don't see it as a big gamble. We think that the problems were understandable and fixable. You know, we're already hearing that some of their major customers, companies like Ryanair, O'Leary, the CEO, has already said he'd be willing to buy more airplanes. So that's a strong endorsement for the airplane after the crashes. We hear Southwest pilots are ready to fly the airplane again. So we think essentially it isn't a huge gamble. And I think Boeing has to be very mindful here because there's a lot of demand for airliners, for the A320 and 737 narrow-body aircraft around the world. And, you know, Airbus has a backlog for the A320 that's 5 or 6 years large. If Boeing were to decide that they didn't want to take all that their suppliers could deliver to them to build 52 airplanes a month, and they're, by the way, they're going to 57. They wanted to go to 57 at the end of the year. They'll probably step up to 57 next year. But if they don't take that bandwidth from their suppliers, they run the risk that Airbus could say, hey, we want to increase production rates for the 320, try to take some market share here, and they would go into suppliers and try to contract some of the bandwidth that Boeing's giving up. And suppliers are stretched right now, so you want to make sure that they are focused on you supplying your airplane. So I think Boeing almost has to take this gamble if they want to maintain their market share.
This International Air Transport Association event in Seoul, can this benefit Boeing? What do they have to do at a gathering like this?
Yeah, so I'm not totally sure what activities they'd have planned there, but definitely the people in the room will be people that companies, airlines, and people in the aerospace business that Boeing wants to continue to influence on the 737 MAX. And so I really think, you know, Boeing's work right now is, I think they understand the problem with the MAX, and I think they have a software fix in place that makes the airplane safer. The challenge now is to convince all the regulatory authorities and the other constituents, the airlines, the pilots, that the fix is sufficient, complete, and the airplane's ready to get back into global fleets. And so I would imagine there'll be some work done on that front at this IATA meeting. I'm sure there'll be plenty of conversations about it. I think Boeing will use all kinds of venues like this to continue to influence the constituents that, or at least, you know, show the details on the fix and continue to try to assuage people's fears and get people focused on putting this airplane back into fleets.
Our thanks to George Ferguson, Senior Aerospace Defense and Airlines Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. Let's pivot to tech now as Apple gets set to kick off its Worldwide Developers Conference. Here for a preview is John Butler, Senior Telecom Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. John, welcome. So Apple shares have been under a bit of pressure lately. Are they sort of losing their way?
I think a lot of that has to do with China concerns, Bob. Mm. You know, there's really been fear of retribution from the Chinese authorities or Chinese government, I should say, for what we've done with Huawei in blacklisting the company. And so, you know, people look at Apple and fear that the company may be in the crosshairs of any retribution there. Nothing yet of great substance, but we'll see.
This developers conference is important because it gets into the area where Apple is seeing some growth, and that is services.
Apple is all about services. It really is where the growth is centered for this company. And it's still small. It's about 20% of revenue, roughly, give or take. But it's growing much faster than the iPhone. And when you think about that installed base of 900 million iPhones and 1.4 billion Apple devices out there, you can see there's sort of a ready-made market for Apple services. And so every June they hold a developers conference where they host app developers, and they use it as a forum for introducing updates to the operating systems on all their devices, but also some updates to popular apps like iMessage, for example.
Not so long ago, there was a lot of concern that Apple was not being as innovative as perhaps it should be. I saw the announcement for the new iPod. That's been around forever.
It has. I think they're a little bit out of runway on the device front, right? They're mm-hmm. in most major categories. Computers, smartphones, digital music players, et cetera. So there's not a lot of new categories that they can get into. And therefore, again, the focus is shifting now to services. And you noticed in the past 6 months, they also unveiled some new content services. So they're getting into the original content game. It's still early days there, but I think that holds a lot of promise as well.
I wonder, when we talk services, who's the competition?
So Android has the Play Store, and they have their own apps there, and there are third-party app developers as well. So, you know, Apple hosts a lot of them on the platform and charges a fee for selling their apps, but in a way they compete with the homegrown Apple apps as well.
Thanks to John Butler, senior telecom analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, we head to Asia, where central bank decisions are set to dominate the agenda this week. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live to New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Radio Plus app and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak.
I'm Bob Moon in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. Up later in the program, President Trump heads to the U.K., at a turbulent time in British politics. But first, let's turn to Asia, where rate cuts are top of mind for investors as India's central bank issues a key policy decision. Bloomberg Daybreak Asia anchors Brian Curtis and Doug Christner are standing by for more.
Bob, thank you. Well, the Reserve Bank of India may leave its repo rate unchanged next week due to a host of uncertainties when it meets. We have oil prices, concerns about a pickup in inflation, and even the monsoon. Doug and I thought it'd be an excellent time to look at the investment climate in India, given the big election victory of Prime Minister Narendra Modi and the big jump in the Sensex just afterwards. Our guest is Bloomberg reporter Anirban Nag. First, Anirban, do you agree with that assessment that the RBI will probably leave the repo rate unchanged?
It's likely so. And one of the reasons are that they have cut interest rates both in February as well as in April. Much of those rate cuts haven't actually transmitted into the broader economy, partly because the financial conditions have been very tight. The cash position is extremely scarce, with banks not lending, shadow banks in a bit of crisis. So the borrowers are not actually able to get or see the benefits of these rate cuts being transmitted. So overall, what the RBI is feeling within the RBI is that we've had these two rate cuts. We want to see how these rate cuts pan out before we take further measures. One of the measures that is likely to be taken next week, perhaps, is easing of these liquidity levers. The RBI is expected to inject billions of rupees into the cash system so that rate transmission actually takes place.
So we know that the global economy is slowing. That's obviously one headwind, and I would imagine that weak exports are part of the story in India. Oil prices have been a story for much of the year, although recently we've seen a little bit of a pullback in the price of oil. Is it likely that India can continue to grow at or above 7% for the remainder of the financial year?
That's a very good question. I think a lot of it is going to depend upon how much Prime Minister Modi and his forthcoming budget in July is able to deliver. There are expectations that there will be a bit of more fiscal stimulus from the budget, partly because private investment has been held back before the general election. Consumption has taken a bit of a hit because shadow banks, who have been the engine of growth, have not been lending. So both public as well as private investments have taken a bit of a hit. The government on its side is probably going to push the public side of investments through more construction, through more infrastructure building, as well as rural spending. They will be giving farmers, the poorest of farmers, 6,000 rupees for the whole year. So now we're going to see those spending boost the economy. That's what the expectation is. So that should take the Indian economy past 7%, whether it can grow to its potential of 8% or 8.5%, I do not think that's going to be immediately possible.
Doug mentioned the trade war, and here in the past 2 weeks, during a time when the Sensex went up about 7 or 8%, most of the other equity markets around the rest of the world have fallen about 4 or 5%. So it seems that foreign investors like the story of Modi and maybe infrastructure spending and some projects, will they be proven correct?
Well, they might just be proven correct. Part of the reason why the Sensex also ran up was because there's this huge relief rally that took place once it was very clear that Mr. Modi was coming back to power with an improved mandate. Now, the improved mandate means that both the lower houses and within 2 years, the upper house also will probably move to the ruling side, where it becomes easier for Prime Minister Modi to carry out very tough land and labor reforms past the legislature. He has been hampered in the past by the upper house being in minority, and that has proven to be an Achilles heel in his legislative reform process. So this time, if by 2020, when he has both the upper house and the lower house within his majority, there are chances that both labor and land reform takes place, and that should help the manufacturing sector really grow. The flagship Make in India, which Mr. Narendra Modi has been promoting, should take off. So foreign investors probably are quite right in being bullish on India.
Anirban, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your insights. Bloomberg's Anirban Nag, who covers the macro economy for us in India. I'm Doug Krisner, along with Brian Curtis in Hong Kong. You can catch us every weekday here for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia, beginning at 6 a.m. in Hong Kong, 6 p.m. on Wall Street. Bob?
Thank you, Doug and Brian. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, we head to our Bloomberg 99.1 studios in Washington for a look at what's ahead in D.C. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Coming up, a look at the agenda in Washington. But first, President Trump travels to the UK this week against a backdrop of political uncertainty for Britain. For more, let's head to London and bring in Bloomberg Europe Daybreak anchor Matt Miller.
Bob, the U.S. president's state visit to the UK happens at a tumultuous time in British politics. Theresa May is stepping down as Tory party leader on June 7th. That means that on this trip, Donald Trump, who has been vocal about supporting Brexit, will join a lame duck prime minister who failed to deliver it. For more, I'm joined in the London studio by Bloomberg U.S. politics reporter Kathleen Hunter and by Bloomberg U.K. government reporter Alex Morales. Alex, let me start with you because to make it clear what's happening with Theresa May, she's stepping down as the party leader. As I understand it, she will remain prime minister, although clearly a lame duck, until what? Until someone else is elected?
Yeah, I mean, we expect that to be the end of July. She announced that, so her resignation as party leader actually takes effect from Friday. So she's still party leader while Trump's here. And then on Friday, the official nominations process begins for the leadership contest, but already 11 Tories have put their names forward. So it's going to be quite a crowded field.
It seemed also like she picked the date for her resignation as party leader to coincide with the end of Trump's visit, or as if she wanted to stay party leader while he was here. Why would that be?
Well, I think it would have been a bit more tumultuous if she'd quit the week before he was coming, and then he was left on a state visit with with an even more lame duck prime minister whilst the leadership contest was underway.
It's no less tumultuous, frankly, in the U.S., Kathleen. And, I mean, yes, Donald Trump is still president. He even, by a lot of accounts, has a decent chance at re-election. But the Mueller report or the Mueller testimony really pushed the Democrats in Congress to do something towards the aim of impeachment.
Absolutely. In some ways, it's a good time for Trump to be piecing on out of the U.S., given that the Democrats are under increasing pressure to pursue some sort of an impeachment proceeding against him. Now, of course, I think it's important to remember that for Democrats, that carries a certain amount of potential risk as well, given, especially as they get closer to the election, there's really not, it's a big gamble to assume how the public's going to react to that. It certainly could backfire. But certainly in the short term for Trump, this gives him an opportunity to sort of step away from the issues that are plaguing him domestically. Go on a state visit, the kind of thing that can make him look presidential, focus on that sort of statesmanship aspect of his job. That being said, what we know about Trump, you know, we can just look as recently as his Japan trip to see that he often brings domestic politics abroad with him and brings those topics up when he's traveling overseas as well. And so we may see that happen again. We may see him come to the UK and start talking about congressional investigations back in Washington. So with Trump, you just never know.
He's very likely to talk about Brexit, right? Alex, in the past, he hasn't
shied away from wading into that battle.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. I mean, he's not been very helpful to the Prime Minister on Brexit. He last came in August, I think, last year, and he preceded that with an interview with one of the with the UK's biggest circulating tabloid, The Sun, in which he essentially criticised the Brexit deal she'd come back with and said he didn't think that if the UK got that sort of deal that they'd be able to strike a trade deal with the US.
And he's been supportive of Boris Johnson, right? Is he currently in the lead for replacing May?
Yeah, so Boris Johnson, who's the former Foreign Secretary, is the favourite to succeed Theresa May. Now, it's important to say that in Tory party leadership contests, the favourite very rarely wins. So he's in the lead at the moment, but he might yet come down.
Thanks to Bloomberg reporters Kathleen Hunter and Alex Morales for that look ahead to President Trump's visit to the UK. I'm Matt Miller in London. You can catch us every weekday morning here for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 6 a.m. in London and 1 a.m. on Wall Street. Bob?
Thanks, Matt. Now let's head to our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington to see what items in politics and government are set to top the agenda next week. And for that, we bring in Amy Morris, host of our Politics, Policy, Power, and Law program, heard weekdays at noon on Bloomberg Radio. Amy.
Thank you, Bob. In a surprise announcement that could derail a major trade deal, President Trump is now threatening to use tariffs on Mexican goods as a weapon in the fight over immigration. Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney says this latest move by the president is separate from the ongoing talks to ratify USMCA, that's the trade pact between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, and it's supposed to replace NAFTA.
These tariffs will either not go into place or will be removed after they go into place. That is separate and apart from the USMCA, which is a trade matter. These are not tariffs as part of a trade dispute. These are tariffs as part of an immigration problem.
We take a look at how this is going to play out on Capitol Hill with Bloomberg News Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gordon. I want to thank you for taking the time with us. The hot story right now, tariffs. It was a surprise announcement coming from the White House. Tell us what you anticipate for the coming week on Capitol Hill when lawmakers get back and they have to wrestle with this.
Sure. It's been interesting. Actually, the tariff, the whole trade war question is one where Republicans are starting to get a little restive. You know, a lot of these folks have manufacturers, farms, you know, all those things in their states and in their districts. And Donald Trump is kind of tromping around like a bull in a china shop right now, you know, knocking things over and breaking a lot of things. Donald Trump would say, I have to do this because China's treating us unfairly. And the Mexico tariffs just announced very suddenly, you know, we have to stop this illegal immigration. Mexico's not doing enough. So these are two hugely important national priorities. And if tariffs are the tool I have to execute it, then that's what I'm going to do. Members of Congress would say, not so fast, buddy. Like this affects American jobs. It affects prices in the stores. It affects a lot of things. And now you have on the China front, China talking about retaliating against U.S. technology companies. On the Mexico front, obviously a lot of automakers. If you're driving a car in America right now, there's a part that came from Mexico in there somewhere. So, you know, car prices could go up. Labor costs could go up. All of those things could start to happen. Easy for Trump to say. He can look like the tough guy as he stands for re-election in 2020 and tell his voters, a lot of blue-collar folks and stuff, hey, I'm fighting the good fight. For a lot of these individual members of the House and individual senators, the pain comes a lot closer to home, and they have to answer for it, and they're starting to get frustrated.
And I got
to
ask if he's just undermined not just Congress, but the vice president, who was just in Canada trying to button up USMCA.
I will tell you, I mean, I get paid to pay attention to this stuff, and even I had a little head-snapping moment when these were announced, because I said, didn't we just lift the steel and aluminum tariffs on Mexico
right. And
Canada? Didn't we? Did I miss something here? What happened? So, yeah, I mean, within literally a week of making, or a week or two of making that very big announcement, and a step a lot of people thought, you know, was a positive step forward in trying to get relations back on track with those two obviously major allies and major trading partners. As you say, Vice President Pence sitting with Justin Trudeau up in Ottawa there. All of a sudden we're back in the tariff game. And I think a lot of folks, and as you say, members of Congress were just as surprised as I was.
Yeah, it was surprising for everyone. We're going to keep watching this with you. Thank you so much. Bloomberg News, Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gordon. And that is what is happening in the nation's capital. I'm Amy Morris. You can catch me every weekday on Bloomberg Politics, Policy, Power, and Law at noon, Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. Bob.
Amy Morris reporting from our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington. Thanks, Amy. Let's head to the commodity space for the week ahead now. And for that,
We bring in Bloomberg's Jessica Summers. Good day to you, Jessica.
Bob, the summer driving season just kicked off with pump prices around $2.82 a gallon on average here in the U.S. Now, that's about 14 cents lower than last year at this time. And if you're passing through Louisiana or Mississippi, that's where you'll find the cheapest gasoline. Now, Bloomberg's Oil Trading America's team leader, David Marino, joins me here in New York to discuss gasoline production and what may hold refiners back from meeting demand. Nice to have you on, Dave.
Thanks, Jessica.
Refiners in the U.S. are facing limited supplies of heavy crude from Venezuela and Iran, which is the type of oil most of their plants are designed to process in order to make products like gasoline. Energy Aspects analyst Imrita Sen spoke to Bloomberg TV on the topic. Let's take a listen.
So what these guys are doing is they're being forced to run lighter crudes, which means they just cannot run to their design specification. So you are getting lower runs, and in turn, you're getting less products.
So how is this shortage of heavy crude going to affect gasoline production this summer here in the U.S.? What are the challenges right now for refiners?
We could see production this summer lower than in recent years due to refiners adjusting operations to run lighter crudes. That could pull down inventories that are right now in the Gulf Coast really high. And that'll help support profit margins for refiners. But there's no concern about a shortage of gasoline around the country right now. Stockpiles in Texas and Louisiana are the highest this time of year in data going back to 1990, even as a lot of refineries were shut for seasonal maintenance. In fact, the biggest pipeline running from Texas to the eastern U.S. was running below capacity for much of the spring, which is very unusual. Now, prices had jumped out in the West Coast and Los Angeles and San Francisco after some refinery fires, but even those are coming down now.
Interesting. Now, if we do see lackluster production, you know, refinery run rates are at the lowest seasonally since 2016, will we also then see higher prices at the pump throughout the summer? What's it going to take to keep prices down for drivers?
We won't necessarily see higher prices. Demand appears to be flattening out, and there are broader concerns about global economic growth and the trade war that are keeping futures contracts, futures prices in check. Of course, it just takes one hurricane to send prices spiking.
That is very true. Now, I do have to bring up gasoline imports to the U.S. recently hitting that 8-year high. Why did we see that? It's not likely to continue, though, right?
It's not likely to keep going. We had a surge in imports after some refinery fires out in the West Coast, but the market just redirected supply. There was cargoes came from Europe and even Asia to the West Coast. And now prices are coming back down there. So there's definitely a perception that any brief local tight supply will be met through pipeline shipments as well as imports from Canada, Europe, and Asia.
Dave, thanks very much for joining me. This is one of the topics we're watching in commodities for the week ahead. In New York, I'm Jessica Summers. Bob?
Thank you, Jessica. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday morning at 5 Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.